Over the last 20 years, we've watched Jeff Gulovich evolve and grow from a fresh-faced 13-year-old Grom into one of the most recognized free riders in our sport. His career started about the same time that riding on the North Shore achieved worldwide renown, and the two have grown together. From cedar skinnies up in the sky to today's modern flowy style, he has been there. First as a young local ripper with parts in Digger's North Shore Extreme video series, then moving on to global recognition with a big online following, working with companies like GoPro and Lululemon in addition to his bike industry sponsors. Throughout that time, Gully has been a mainstay in videos as well as freeride and slopestyle competitions like Joyride and Rampage, earning accolades and results, but also the respect and admiration of fellow riders, fans, and the industry as a whole. His easygoing nature and friendly demeanor comes as naturally as greasing a massive booter, and that may be what people like most about him, but there are no shortage of reasons to be a fan. No boasting or ego here, just a grown-up kid who likes to have fun on his bike, who has matured along with the sport that he loves, and has brought us along for the ride. I'm Pete Roggeman, and this is episode 5 of the NSMB podcast. And for this one, Cam McRae and I sat down together with Jeff Gulovich, known to many of us as Gully, to dive a little deeper.
I'm Jeff Gulovich. This is my third podcast ever, and I have an abnormally large gun tattooed on my right leg.
That almost sounded like something else for a second. So my first question for you, Gully, is when your first ride with a pro happened and what that was like.
I think I had to be about 12 years old, and I just met Jay Hoots at the BC Indoor Bike Show, and we were talking about maybe getting me some pads, and he wanted to come see how I could ride. So he linked up with me and a bunch of my buddies at William Griffin Skate Bowl. We used to hang out there and just play around in the bowl, and he began showing us lines that he'd been doing there for a number of years, and that got us all stoked, and we were learning new things on the fly. It was an absolute blast.
How did you start riding a mountain bike?
Well, all my brother's friends were into riding bikes, and they're about 3 years older than me, and I was just that pesky younger brother that you just couldn't get rid of. They showed me North Shore Extreme 2 when I was just turned 12 at, like, Thanksgiving dinner, and I watched that, saw what the guys were doing, and I was hooked immediately, and I didn't even have a bike yet.
So how did you solve that? What was your first bike?
I got myself a paper route and started saving up that $60 every 2 weeks to get myself a Norco Kathmandu.
Do you remember how much it cost you?
Yeah, it was $325 before taxes.
And how long did it take you to break something?
First day. Yeah, we actually had a mellow ride, and then it fell off my buddy's mom's bike rack over a speed bump and tacoed the back wheel. I wasn't even riding it.
All right. So I guess you kept that paper route so you could replace parts as you went.
Didn't have a choice. Yeah. I started working at McDonald's at later on in the year when I was still 12. My parents were nice enough to forge my application so I could work.
You worked illegally at McDonald's.
You betcha.
What did working at McDonald's teach you?
How to quit a job. How to cook fries. Customer service for sure.
did you have some unique way of quitting?
Yeah, I told them I was moving to Kamloops. And they're like, what do you mean you're moving to Kamloops? I'm like, yeah, I don't know. My parents just sprung it on me. And then a week later, I was in there getting food.
Why did you do that?
I hated it, man.
Well, why didn't you just say I quit because I hate it here?
I think I was just too nervous at the time to...
Didn't want to let anybody down?
Yeah, I didn't want to give a truthful answer. I was worried of what they would think. But Now I think I'd walk up and just be like, I'm out. I'm taking a milkshake with me.
So did you have, besides the paper route and working at McDonald's, did you have any other real jobs before you?
Yeah, I washed dishes at Swiss Chalet. I worked at Ambleside Cycles. I worked at On Top Bike Shop. And then my final job was at a pizza place in West Van called Presto Cucina. And that was a riot. It was just, it was run by my buddy's mom. And it was just a bunch of my buddies and I hanging out, flipping pizzas.
When did it seem to you like mountain biking might be a job or a career?
I knew I wanted to do it as soon as I began riding, but I just didn't know how. And so started riding with better people more often, and that just progressed me so quickly. It was probably around 15 that it actually became an option, and I was fully committed to it.
As a 12 or 13-year-old who had just seen North Shore Extreme 2 and knew you wanted to do this, you were always a free rider, so I'm imagining you weren't looking up to racers and saying, I want to be that. So who were you looking at? Because I imagine there weren't that many making their living mountain biking without being racers. Who were you looking to for inspiration there, and what were they telling you when you eventually would meet
them? I was definitely watching people like Wade Simmons, Dave Watson, Andrew Shandro, Brett Tippy, Richie Schley, Dangerous Dan even. Like, I was seeing what they were doing, and they were doing it full time, and I wanted to do that as well. And, yeah, don't get me wrong, like, I admire the hell out of racers, and they are incredibly talented and much faster than me, but just, I never had any interest in racing.
Did you ride with the Flow Show at all?
I did a handful of shows. I did, Gross Mountain World Cup, I believe, 01 and 02, I did some in a mall out in Metrotown at Edgemont Village. I think that might be all of them. But yeah, I did a couple of Flow shows.
Can you describe the Flow show for people who have never seen a Flow show?
The Flow show is a series of mountain bike acrobatic lines that are set up. And there's always like one showtime drop that's 12, 15 feet high with this little wooden landing that's just placed in the parking lot. So if you overshoot that thing, you're done. If you case it, you're done.
Or if it collapses like it did sometimes.
Oh, God, I can't believe that show went on for as long as it did. Like, one bolt loose, one anything, and you're going for a tumble. But other than that, it was nuts. It was just, like, actually the skinniest ramp set up in a parking lot. And for me at least, I don't know about those guys, but like, you would mess up in a show and like, it's embarrassing. You go back and try it again, but yeah, it was fun, but I don't know. It was kind of like my entry to performing on the spot. And it was pretty fun, to be honest.
I wonder how growing up in the North Shore impacted your development as a rider.
I believe I'm absolutely a product of my environment. Like, I still to this day love skinnies and features. Like, if there's a log ride or something next to a jump, I'm probably going to hit the log ride. It's just embedded in me now. I used to love seeing these features and shooting them for the North Shore Extreme movies, among others. Like, it's a blast. It's just one of those things that you grow up with and you love it. Some people just want to go fast in open areas. Some people just want to ride the gnarliest, rooty lines, dirt jumping, and so on. I see a skinny. I'm probably going to try it.
That's actually quite different than a lot of your contemporaries, like Wade Simmons and even locals like Jerry Willows, who used to build a ton of skinnies. Those guys hate skinnies.
I know. And it's the funniest thing, but Now, Wade doesn't hate skinnies. If Wade sees a feature, he will hit it.
That's funny, because he always says that.
Oh, man. He is lying through his teeth. I have seen so many janky features that, like, even riding by, I'm like, ah, that looks like it's going to collapse. And then I'll just look over my shoulder, and Simmons is on top of it. All right, buddy. Keep telling yourself you hate skinnies.
So as a young guy, riding and improving and working your way through all of this, who were some of the older guys, not only that you looked up to, but maybe ones that helped you along? And tell us a little bit about how that was for a 14, 15-year-old who was riding with his idols and maybe using them to help figure out how to make a career out of it.
For sure. Jay Hoots was definitely huge in my life. Like, he introduced me to the entry level of the business side of it. He was giving me my first gear. Dangerous Dan was pretty cool because we started shooting together with North Shore Extreme, and then he brought me into the Flow Show, kind of taught me performance or competition, if you will. And then Dave Watson, Andrew Shandro, those guys kind of fine-tuned the business side of it for me. They taught me just how to go through all the procedures, read through a contract, negotiate. That was a big one that I picked up from Shandro, because he's a business guy through and through. There's tons out there. Tippy and Bearcloth have work ethics like no other. They will shoot from sunup to sundown again until they're satisfied with what the content is. Man, there's so many others that have been so clutch in my upbringing and just teaching me all the ways of the industry. Jeez, I don't know. Gabe Fox, he was crucial to me, giving me my first bike contract and introducing me to all of his contacts. That was huge. I'll never forget that. And I'm sure there's many more, but it's been a long time. My brain's old.
Can you tell me about how the North Shore has changed since you were a wee lad?
The shore has changed a lot. Like, you could almost say it's gone 360, because I would assume that most of the trails were pretty bare bones and raw back in the day. And then the whole North Shore trend picked up, where ladder bridges were being made, where originally it started maybe to get over a creek or something. Then it just exploded to completely unnecessary, ridiculous features all over the trail. And that was a blast, but now it's gone back to fast, smooth, raw terrain, and new trails just basically get raked in. There's no woodwork anymore. So I would say it's gone full 360, but I wasn't around when it first started.
So do you miss some things about the janky days of the North Shore?
Of course. That's what I grew up on. I used to love that stuff. It's just, it was just so fun. Like, you get to a feature on the trail that was technical, and you would session it. It's like, you might make it through first go, might take you five goes, but, like, either way, you're riding with friends, and everybody wants to see everybody get through it. So you're sitting there cheering on your pals or trying to do it yourself. And that's one thing I kind of miss. Like, now and then when you get to a new trail and there's a big jump line or something technical, you'll do that, but it just doesn't show the same, it doesn't have the same feeling it used to have. But still amazing. Can't really go wrong out there.
I want to talk about travel, because it seems to be a huge part of your work, and also you seem to travel even when you're not working. And there are a lot of riders who kind of prefer to stay home but have to travel, and you seem to really love it. What is it about far off places that draws you?
Well, I've traveled so much for a competition in the past, and it was always a little bit irritating, because you'd show up to these beautiful destinations, basically acclimate, train, compete, after party, and leave. And going to all these amazing countries, you never saw anything. You never really got immersed in the culture, didn't eat much of the local food because you were like too focused on competition. You want to stick to what you knew. And now having the freedom to go do actual adventure trips and dive into the culture, eat the food, meet amazing people, and see landscapes that are unfamiliar, that's something I've always wanted to do since beginning to travel. And I'm absolutely obsessed with it. I want to see every corner of the earth before I'm done riding. And being able to bring a bike and ride these incredible places as well, that's just the cherry on top.
Can you tell us about some recent trips you've had that have been memorable?
Yeah, last year was bananas. Started off the year with a six-week trip to Germany. Where'd I go? Nepal. And then straight to Bali. All for three different shoots. And it was... that was absolutely insane. Like, imagine packing for negative 20 to plus 30 in one bag. Like, the only thing I had enough for every day was socks. And then everything else was getting worn and worn again. It was a very stinky trip.
You did one sort of suitcase and then a backpack as well? Is that...
yeah.
Man.
I threw a couple pieces in my bike bag, but I was maxed out.
But you had, in the end, everything you needed?
Well, packing for Bali wasn't too hard. It was like, oh, bathing suit, let's go.
Speedo?
But yeah. But Nepal was wild. Like, we anticipated cold temperatures, but it got down to negative 17 one night when we were at around 14,000 feet and snowing on us, and we're all huddled in this one like plywood hut. And it's just blatant holes in the walls. And we actually all pushed the beds together because everybody had like a plus two bag or something like that. I was the only one with a negative 10. And it was still colder than that. And it was a memorable night.
bunch of spoons.
Do you look back more fondly on trips like that where there was an element of discomfort versus ones like Bali, or are they different kinds of happy memories, and do you chase them equally when you're planning in future?
I think so. I think I definitely chase them equally. The ones that you definitely work harder for are more rewarding in the end, and you will have pretty amazing memories, hopefully. Like going to Bali in addition is, it's unreal. Like, every morning before shooting, you get up and go surf for an hour. Then you're warmed up and ready for the day. Then temperatures spike at like 35 degrees and you haven't eaten and you get heat stroke. And you just go with the blows, right? Like, I love traveling. I love working. I love creating good product. And if I can add a unique, memorable adventure to that, then we're laughing. You have my full attention.
I read somewhere that you try to bring a knife back from every trip you go on.
I do. That's actually true. Yeah. I if a country is known for some sort of cool blade, then I always bring one home, and I have a whole little dresser full of these cool little knickknacks that I collect all over the world. And like Nepal, their special forces there uses a very unique knife. And it's almost got like this inward curvature to it. And I had to get one of those, and that would probably retail for $300-$400 here, just $12 there. And yeah, why not bring something like that home? It's incredible. It tells a story, and every time I see one, I can tell you exactly where I got it. Maybe not the date, but I can tell you where it's from and all the history behind it.
Cool. Have you ever forgotten one in your carry-on?
I've been fortunate enough not to do that. However, I've had two or three taken off me by authorities, but they were really nice about it. It was like, you know, you can't have that. I'm like, but I always carry one. It's just like a tool, right? Like, sometimes you need a shotgun and a beer. How are you going to open that? But yeah, it's, I always have one. I had some special ones made for my wedding for my groomsmen from Ethan Nell's dad. He's an extremely well-known knife crafter in Utah. And, yeah, I carry it on me every day. And it's a tool. not a weapon. So I hate when people say like, oh, you carry a knife, you're a tough guy. You're like, no, I actually use this, like working on your bike or whatever, like cutting tape, anything little, opening packages. There's a lot of packages that come to my house and you don't want to go find something to open it. There you go. You're done.
Are you carrying one right now?
I am.
Well, let's see it.
Yeah. This is the one I got made for the wedding for all the groomsmen.
So that's handmade by Ethan Nell's dad.
That's right.
Wow. That's beautiful.
It's carbon fiber.
Yeah.
Is the blade, is that titanium or something?
Is that Damascus tie on the clip?
It is.
Yeah.
I think the blade, I can't recall. It's like a heat treated steel, I believe. But it's incredible. It's just a beautiful piece. And then all the other groomsmen have a nice gloss clip right there, and he did that for me. Yeah.
Yeehaw.
It's pretty special.
That's very cool.
So what's the next knife you plan to collect or the next destination you want to go to collect one?
I kind of take it as it comes, you know. Like Nepal, I had no clue about their history with their beautiful knives, and that was killer. I got an Opinel when I was in the town in France where they originated from. I have a beautifully crafted Austrian, like full gloss knife. Austria knife, really nice. Yeah, I'm getting sidetracked with all this. But. Yeah, it's just cool. One of those weird little things, like. Some people collect watches or something like that, and this is something that's fairly reasonable and has some history and craft to it that I find very interesting.
I'd like to talk about your competitive history, about Rampage and Slopestyle events, and how those two compare, and how Rampage in particular has changed over the years.
Some of the guys that made appearance for the first time at this year's Rampage, they had to work with bare bones. But like that being said, like you really just need to visualize your line and be willing to work with others. And then diving right into the big moves. You need to be focused, need to be on it, well rested. And that's hard to do when you're digging all day and you're staying an hour away. So if you forget anything back at your place, you're going for a drive. And then, yeah, picking off lines in your run one by one by one, and then being able to tie it all together. Your practice there is actually very minimal. And so to be able to throw tricks into it as well, you're basically risking your year's placing for every line you're guinea pigging. Like, what if this goes wrong? There's no one else to guinea pig these big moves you're making. It's all up to you. So it's a stressful one, but when it all comes together, you're so relieved and just so overfilled with joy. It's there's not much like it. Where Slopestyle is, how badass am I? Track's right there. I have 2 days to practice. What can I do? And that, I always found that such a blast because you're actually sessioning with everybody. Like, there is the competitive feel there. You can definitely sense different energies from people, like people that want to actually talk about the course. And there's the dudes that are head down, music in, just fully pinned and committed. And I was a talker. Might be a surprise, but still am. And yeah, it was just fun sessioning. Like Kurt Sorge, Graham Agassi, Zink, like a lot of those dudes. Like, we would be like, what do you think about that? You think you could flip that drop? Like, if I do it, you're going to do it. All right. And you just go in. Like, Kurt and I flipped our first drop at Crankworx, Colorado. We just got up one morning. We were the first two on course. And we rock, paper, scissors for who had to flip this drop first. And we'd never flipped a drop before. It was a step down. And
it's flat drop.
No, there's a lip on it. Like, at the time, it was like a lip step down. And that's what it just... No one had flipped a flat drop yet. And we literally rock, paper, scissored for it. And I won, so I had to go first. because that's such a privilege.
You won, so you lost.
It kind of is, though, because you haven't seen anything fail. So you kind of have this blind ignorance where you're like, I know what I'm doing. I got this. And I just pedaled down into this ramp, lips coming up, and I just tucked into it, and it worked. And I greased a flip my first step down, and I was losing it. And Kurt's like, how was it? I'm like, terrifying, but you got it. And that's kind of what we went on. It's like, how fast do you go for this lip? Oh, you know, you hit the corner, trail speed, then you give it a brop, brop. Okay, that's a double brop? Yeah, cool. All right, let's go. And like, we would guinea flip things in a train. And it's just the stupidest thing ever, but it was so much fun. And then when it came down to comp mode, like, obviously you're supporting your boys, but you're very focused on your own run. And yeah, slopestyle days were fun, man. Just a bunch of idiots having a time.
Was it harder for you to... You stepped away from slopestyle before you stepped away from Rampage. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, I can't remember my last crane course was. It was probably 16. And yeah, I just felt like the kids coming up, they had me beat. I could throw my best run and I'd be lucky to top 10. And I just recognized that. I'd rather leave on a good note as opposed to being pushed out. So to open a spot up to someone who's willing to absolutely send it seems like the right thing to do.
So was it harder to step away from Rampage?
No.
It was just the timing was different, but you were equally ready.
No, yeah, I felt like I'd done what I could there. And I had a couple serious crashes at my last Rampage. Like I could hardly walk under my own power the day of competition. I crashed a guinea pig the Oakley Sender that year. And I was checking it out, and I asked one of the builders if the dimensions were the exact same as the year before. Structure looked the same. They're like, oh yeah, all good, same speed. I was like, all right. And so going into it, I was like, man, I'm going too slow. But I was confident that it was the same as the year before. Went off, and I was like, holy shit, I'm going to double wheel case the top of this landing.
Oh.
And so I ejected over my handlebars. And as I was falling, it was one of those moments where you're like, wow, I'm really screwed. And I tucked my arms in, so I wouldn't break those on the ground. And I decided just to let my legs give out when I impacted. And I impacted so hard that I left about a 6-inch impression with my feet like perfectly pressed into the top of the landing. Tomahawk down the landing, right into walk. And medics are running over. And there wasn't a sound from anybody. And I was just like, fuck, fuck. Like, what's wrong? I'm like, I didn't make it. And I was okay for the most part. But I was so sore the next day that I actually needed my bike as a crutch to make it look like I could walk. And even Todd came over. He's just like, ah, good to see you out. You're looking good. I was just like, feeling good. As he gave me a big pat on the back, I was like, yep. But yeah, that was kind of the point where I was just like, yeah, I'm good. I had a good run here. I did 5 Rampages. I got a 5th place, a top 10 a couple times. I'm happy with that.
That crash influenced your decision if you'd...
Yeah. That was a tough one. It was probably the gnarliest crash I've ever had, and somehow I was pretty okay.
That is impressive. And then, how was it doing your run after you were
hurt? It was terrible. Like, I first run, I got offline, missed my flip drop, held it together though, and I got my big spin off the last like 15 foot drop. And then went back up for my second run. And I had a good line coming in. I flipped my drop at the top of the mountain. And I just went so fast into it. I landed about 15 feet deeper than where I was supposed to. Held it together. but there's a sharp turn on my exit, and I just clipped my pedal on the inside and got tossed into an uphill. And that was about the moment where I was like, I'm really sore. I think I'm going to go sit down. But first round was pretty good. I think I finished 10th or 11th that year, and I'm happy to walk away healthy with that.
Yeah, there's some bad things that can happen.
Absolutely.
I was curious because I dug up an interview that you did with Fox News.
Yeah.
Back then, and I think it was probably spurred on by a helmet cam that you'd recorded of your run, and I think that was about 2014.
Right.
And we know now that you have for some time now had a solid relationship with GoPro. Was that the beginning of it, or were you already working with them then?
I was already working with GoPro at the time, but they did really enjoy that. It's not often that Fox News picks up mountain biking. So I was actually down in LA doing an IXS shoot, I think, with Ali DeLulo and Richie Schley. And Fox News called me, and I was like, excuse me? Is this a joke? They're like, no, we want to have you out at one of our satellite locations to do an interview. Where are you in Vancouver? I was like, actually, I'm in LA right now. They're like, okay, we'll send you a car in the morning. Be ready at 5:45. I was like, what's going on? And GoPro and Rocky wanted me to bring my bike with me at the time. So they send this beautiful town car. And I like took off my wheels. I'm sitting in the back seat with like the wheels on me because there's not enough room in the trunk for everything. Like, it was absurd. And so I get my bike there, and they're like, "Oh no, there's no bike in this shot." I'm like, "Cool, thanks, guys." But yeah, that was pretty exciting.
Obviously, a lot of very mainstream media type of questions about that one.
Oh man, it was so funny. And how fast were you going down the mountain? Like, how many miles an hour? Like, 50? And on the tip of my tongue, I was about to be like, well, in kilometers, which the rest of the world uses, I was like, probably shouldn't do that.
I have to use freedom units.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was those type of questions. It's just like, were you nervous? It's like, yeah, dude, of course I was nervous. Have you seen the footage? heck of an experience, though.
We haven't talked about Rocky much, but you were there 10 or 11 years riding for them.
11 years, yeah.
I mean, and obviously you got a chance to ride with some of the great names of the free ride world from the time you were young.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences with Rocky over the years and how that's shaped your career.
Riding with Rocky was amazing. From the get-go, I'd just come off a year and a half of injuries. I'd broken my kneecap and then my shin about right after that. And Cove decided to drop me. And at the same time, Wade Simmons and Andreas Hessler really went to bat for me to get me on Rocky. And they were successful, and it was the start to just an amazing decade. Being able to ride with Simmons, Vanderham, Tippy, all the time, doing trips together, bonding. Like, it was some of the more memorable years of my life. And then, I just got to a point where there was no way I could climb the ladder. I could probably segue to somewhere parallel to where I was professionally, but I couldn't get any higher. And this amazing opportunity with Focus came along, and I had to take it. And it's led to an amazing 2 years so far. We're on the third year right now. And that company has been unbelievable for me. Like, just great support. The bikes are outstanding, and I'm stoked that I made that decision.
What are the differences working with a brand like Focus that doesn't have a presence here at home? Obviously, they do in Europe, and they're a much bigger brand over there than I think most people would know. But how has that affected the way that you work and how you plan and undertake all the things that you do for your bike sponsor?
Well, conference calls, for one, are always at a terrible hour for me. It's either 7 a.m. or 11, 12 p.m. But it's been really cool. Like, I do love being over in Europe, and that brings me over there a little more. But being someone that travels all around the world, I have more of a global athlete presence. It's not just a home-based, image. And so being able to work with a company that's not based in North America is almost a non-factor. Just because I travel so much, I'm already spending that much amount of time in Europe. All the content I produce isn't directly to North America. It's visually appealing for the global market. And being able to do that with trail bikes and enduro and free ride on these bikes that they make, it's the biggest market right now. And so that doesn't really have a home. You can do that from wherever, and it works out. I'm trying to think of a good way to wrap that up.
Is your experience in Europe different now that you're involved with a European company? Or are you more well-known there now?
I'd say it's definitely growing. Definitely having more of a presence, like stopping by the Focus office and doing a lot more European-focused events. Name is definitely growing. But it's always been familiar. I've always worked with European brands. I've always spent a couple of months over there every year, and now I'm just doing it a little bit more. So the upsides are pasta, schnitzel, and great coffee. So I'm stoked on it. And to be able to bring my wife over, like, she hasn't spent much time over there. So it's pretty incredible.
Speaking of your wife, how has, congratulations on your marriage.
Thank you
very
much.
When was your wedding?
October 6th of 2018.
October 6, 2018. So you've had a full season as a married, actually two, as a married guy. How has that changed your approach to your work?
Not much at all. She's been there from the beginning. We've been together for 14 years with some brief breaks in there. But she saw it ramp up right from the beginning, like missing my own high school graduation, to being away for her birthday some years. Like, it's just how it goes. And you can't really get too upset if it's a job you really love. Like, if I was going away on trips and complaining that I didn't want to go, then it'd be time to make a couple life changes. But I'm like, oh, it's winter? I'm going to go riding in 30 degrees next week? I'll see you later, babe. Woo! And she's amazing about it. Like, it does get to a point where it's like, okay, do you really need to go on this trip to the coast for 2 days? I'm like,
no. We can go hiking.
But everybody deals with this, and I'm very fortunate to have a job I really enjoy.
Nice. Going back to working with Focus, obviously for European companies, e-bikes are an even larger portion of the business than they are here. What is it like being sponsored with a company where e-bikes are kind of a huge priority?
Honestly, people are going to hate this, but they're so fun. And I was a hater too in the beginning. And then I tried one. I was just like, what is going on here? I climbed from the parking lot to Seven Secret in 12 minutes. Yeah, you can get mad about that, but whatever. They're basically funding our entire industry right now. They serve an amazing purpose for people who might be older, knee problems, things like that. And I call it the time crunch bike or the e-loan bike, because I'm always out there by myself getting a quick lap in on maybe a day in between travels. Like, for instance, right after this, I'm going to get a quick ride in before I pack for my flight tomorrow morning. And it's awesome. Like, yeah, people are going to hate them. There's going to be purists, but you can't please everybody. And they're an incredible technology. They're only going to get better. And honestly, if you hate progress, then go back to the Stone Age. I've had people chirp me on the trails. They're like, "Oh, you're on your cheater bike." I'm like, "Lance was a cheater. He won everything."
That's a great response. Yeah,
like, what? Why get mad? We're out riding bikes, guys.
That's an awesome response.
So trolls and haters maybe brings us to social media a little bit. You're a guy with a good size following. Obviously your work with GoPro gets seen by a lot of eyeballs as well, but one thing that kind of sticks out, if you follow your conversations with people on some of your posts, like anyone else, you've got your share of people who will put a crappy comment in there or say something you have to deal with. You seem to have a very diplomatic and optimistic way of dealing with them that comes across as natural. Is it natural? Have you had to work at it? Do you find yourself pausing over the send button before replying sometimes?
Not really. I've always been fairly shoot from the hip kind of thought process. But one thing that I've learned through the years is you never fight fire with fire. If someone's going to be a dick, who knows? Maybe they're having a bad day. Maybe they're just a dick. And there's not much you can say that's going to change their opinion. So just squash it. Get over it. It's a couple words on the internet. And you got to let it go. You got to have a thick skin if you're doing this, because there's always going to be someone that dislikes you just for who you are. And then there's people that might disagree with things you do. And it's just a downward spiral from there. So you need to have a thick skin and just shake it off. If someone writes something crappy, it's a stupid video, you're like, "Oh, sorry you didn't like it. Hope you feel better. Bye." Who cares?
What? How pivotal, how important is social media for you? I mean, we know it is important. You're an ambassador for brands, but how do you incorporate needing to keep feeding that beast while doing your job and still enjoying your life and not letting it kind of totally consume you?
It's a part of the job now. And I know Simmons hates social media. We call it unsocial media. We laugh about it, but it's a part of the job now. And we're not just athletes anymore. We're athletes in addition to the face in public, in addition to content producers now. It's we're our own little media productions in addition to having to practice and being able to perform on your bike all the time. So the workload's just getting bigger. And if you can't get behind it, then there's not much you can do. There's the odd person that might not do much, but they're killing it in competition. They're going to have a big following no matter what. And then there's others who work solely on social media, and they might not have a personality in real life. But to be the full package, it's part of the job now. And you need to be able to perform or figure it out from there.
Or start selling bikes on Vancouver Island.
Exactly. Yeah.
I might cut that out.
Because he still doesn't control his own Instagram account, right?
Listen, McCray, I know where you live. Oh, shit, Simmons.
GoPro has been, seems like maybe one of the things that's got you to another level on social media.
I would say so.
What has been your approach to GoPro that's had you be so successful?
I kind of just thought the concept was very cool from the beginning. If you do something amazing and get a good POV shot or even a drop cam shot, how cool is that? You don't need to get someone out filming you anymore, even though you can't live without that either. But being able to have such a small tool that you can bring with you anywhere and get some of the most unique content on earth that someone else might not be able to produce, I think it's huge. And GoPro's given me the tools and taught me how to use it properly. And beyond that, it's just practice makes perfect. I've been learning to edit my own photos. I talk to photographers I work with to get advice on how to do that. I talked to videographers to figure out how to edit better. And beyond the tools that they give you and the knowledge that they present you with, it's just repetition and practice. And obviously, fine-tuning a photo is much easier than like creating a good edit. But you just got to keep doing it. Like I said, it's part of the package now. And you need to be willing to put the time in.
What are some mistakes you see people who are new to GoPro or maybe obviously not as professional at it as you, what are some mistakes you see them make?
Camera angles, settings. Like one of the bigger one with the chesty mount that you see often in the bike park is people running it camera up kind of thing. And your perspective is going to be your top tube. You're not going to see anything or maybe just your handlebars. But if you actually turn the camera upside down on your chesty, you can arch it out to an angle that shoots forward when you're in a riding position. And that tells more of a story on its own, be it photo or video. Being able to see your handlebars, your cockpit, but then the trail that's actually coming and possibly the rider that's in front of you. It just creates such a cool story. And then I'd say next would be like camera settings. A lot of people run like 2.7 or 4K, but you want to have that taller frame. So if you're listening, use 2.7K 4x3 framing because that'll give you a taller frame and then you can crop it down to exactly what you want for afterwards. So that's a good fit size for Instagram.
Nice.
Anything else on social or video GoPro stuff?
I don't think so. Not we've got some other stuff.
Pretty good.
Who
is this Chelly boy?
He looks a lot like you. He says some similar things.
Okay. Looking back now on your career, choices you've made, are there any pieces of advice you'd give to a younger Gully at any point along your career? Things you might do differently or situations that you would like a redo?
Well, on my last rampage, I would have loved to have made that landing on the Oakley drop. That would have been a good start.
So was the message from that then, though, that you maybe put your trust in someone else? But
that's
because it's kind of a hard scenario. What would you do differently if you went back to that point in time?
Yeah, you know what? That's a great way to look at it. And I definitely would have trusted myself over someone else's opinion. And I think that's possibly the last time I've ever done that for guinea pigging a feature. So you read way deeper in that than I even knew was possible. As for other mistakes, like I've definitely burnt a couple of bridges, like I'm sure everybody in their professional life has. But those are mistakes that I never forget. Like you learn it hard once and you won't make that mistake a second time. I remember Shander almost killed me when I was like 14. And I was like, God, you're scary. I don't even know how to talk to you.
Are you still scared of him now?
No, I like to pick on him a bit, and I think he enjoys that because not too many people do. But I really admire that dude, and I think he's amazing. But, you know, chill out, bud. Smile every now and then.
What about as you look forward now? We've talked about how much you love the travel, but what do you see in the next couple of years and further on down the road for you in your career and what you would like to do?
Ideally, I'd love to slowly move into some sort of team management on the free ride in front of things, or be it with Focus or something like that. I think that'd be a natural transition considering the experience I've had working with companies, seeing how the planning, forecasting, and spotting young talent goes. Like there's been a handful of kids, so I'm like, we need to get this guy a bike. And then they turn out to be someone amazing. And it's happens all the time. Like that Jackson Riddle kid coming up, Fraser, my buddy Fraser actually pointed him out to me and like look at him now. It's been like 2 years and the kid's like crushing it at Darkfest and he's going to be good. Reed Boggs was another one. Like always a quiet, super nice kid. And now he's absolutely crushing it.
Hmm. Is he somebody that you saw and recognized as a talent before other people?
Reed was. Yeah. I saw him and I was like, he's quiet. Like he'll open up his personality. That kind of comes with age and experience. But he was just on the cusp of being in every big final kind of thing. And now he's killing it at Rampage, like putting out cool videos and just a good kid. Just a good old American boy.
Are there some young riders now who you're working with or who you just ride with and maybe come to you for advice?
There are definitely a couple. Like Henry Fitzgerald, he is an absolute ripper. I remember just coincidentally riding with him and his dad when he was just a little squirt. And now he races some World Cups. Like, very cool to see. Caleb Halanko, that kid is so sick. Like, someone needs to actually get behind that because, like, he's working. He doesn't have time to travel right now. And, like, yeah, someone needs to get him to some events because he is an amazing rider.
Interesting. He's we see him locally, but obviously he needs to get on to a bigger stage.
Yeah, I think, like, Kona's supporting him right now. And I haven't really dug into his personal affairs with, like, travel budget and whatnot, but I would love to see him blow up because he's a strong rider and just a good kid.
Guess we're getting pretty close here. One thing I'm interested to find out about is who are some riders that you admire now? Who are your contemporaries and also who you like to ride with most?
Riders I admire, that's a very long list. There's a lot of the downhill guys are just absolute beasts out there. Like, I love seeing Finn Isles, Brooke McDonald, a lot of those guys absolutely crushing it. In free ride, like, you got like Rob Gatkin, Emil Johansson in slopestyle. Emil was one of those kids that, like, you see, like, first run, you're like, this kid's going to be an absolute psychopath. And again, very soft-spoken, very calculated, and so, so sick on a bike. In free ride, like, I still look up to Simmons, Vanderhem's an absolute beast. Man, I'm at a loss. There's so many amazing riders that I love to see out there. Like, a bunch of my friends too. They crush it and they have zero interest in doing it as a profession. But, like, yeah, it's very cool to see. Sorry, where are we?
anything else for you, Pete?
No, I think we've covered the list.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Gully.
Thank you, guys.
Fantastic to sit down and hear the scoop on helicopter rides and and you teasing Chandro. And maybe we'll be able to do it again in a year or so. See where you are then.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, man.